This episode is brought to you by Indeed.com. In the past, I've hired a lot of different people to help out with my podcast, audio producers, transcriptionists, and hiring the right people is tricky. How do you find good applicants? How do you find someone with the right education and experience? When you hire someone, how do you know you've made the right choice? Well, Indeed can help. I've used them and millions of candidates use Indeed every day to find their next job. You can post a job in minutes and use screener questions to create a short list of applications very quickly. And you can add skills to your job post, so you know you're getting someone with the right skills. Indeed has a library of more than 50 skills that tests ability ranges from different industry-specific abilities, like accounting, to more general aptitude tests like critical thinking. This helps you make hiring decisions quickly, and you can be sure you're adding the right person to your team. Post your job today at Indeed.com/unplugged and get a free sponsored job upgrade on your first posting. That's Indeed.com/unplugged. Terms, conditions, and exclusions apply. This offer is valid through March 31st, 2020. History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. A topic we've come across a few times on this podcast is looking at travelers and explorers. And I think one of the hardest situations that you could face as an explorer was going to polar climates. Worse than being Magellan trying to cross the Pacific, facing scurvy, navigating straits that could crush your ship. Worse than Captain Cook and wondering whether islanders would be friendly or hostile, or what sailors would fear, even cannibals. Because as a polar explorer, you're facing temperatures that can plummet down to 70 to 80 degrees below zero, wolves, polar bears, months and months of darkness, and psychological conditions that drove many men insane. There are many polar expeditions where up to 50% of the crew died. Sometimes ships got stuck in the ice, and there are cases of them having to abandon ship, hike hundreds of miles overland, and even resort to cannibalism. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Buddy Levy, author of the book Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greely Polar Expedition. In 1881, Lieutenant A.W. Greely and a crew of 24 scientists and explorers and a couple of native Greenlanders were bound for one of the last regions unmarked on global maps. They wanted to reach farthest north, which was a record that the British had held for centuries. And they encountered sub-zero temperatures, wolves, months of darkness. But in 1882, they managed to break the 300-year-old record and return to their camp, expecting a supply ship to come at any day in order to give them provisions. But nothing came, and they were forced to wait an additional year. Back in the United States, Greely's wife worked tirelessly to get a rescue mission sent. But as more months passed, Greely made the choice that he and his men would have to take the remaining food and tools and put them on five small boats and push off into the treacherous waters and try to make it south, avoid ice floes, and reach someone, anyone, before they ran out of food and starved to death. So this is an incredible story of survival, and I think it's one of those stories where when you hear it, you think, huh, why didn't I know about this before? So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Buddy Levy. Buddy, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I have a lot of questions for you. I'm really fascinated by this topic. And before we get too far into it, I know that you have personal experience in the Arctic and you did a lot of research about this topic for your book. Being a polar explorer, of all the ways you could be an explorer, whether you're Magellan, whether you're Captain Cook, that sounds the hardest to me of all. What do you think is the hardest thing about polar exploration based on what you saw? Is it the extreme cold, possibly dying of scurvy, polar bears, wolves being cut off from isolation? There's so many things, but what would you point to as being the most challenging thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think if this was a quiz, I'd say all of the above. But having read the accounts from the men and their diaries and stuff, I mean, certainly the remoteness of the location is an incredible challenge because of the fact that they were left there some 400 miles from the North Pole and then left in a ship. So the remoteness and the being just entirely cut off from the rest of the world created not only a physical challenge because of the extreme conditions that they were working and traveling in, but also a psychological isolation that I think worked on them, the men, Greeley and his men, over time. And that's one of those things that isn't talked about so much. You know, I mean, we talk about the physical challenges of extreme cold and weather and the elements, and like you say, polar bears and wolves, but there's this kind of invisible foe, which is, you know, the human psyche and the human mind and imagination. And I think that is a challenge that seafarers also certainly experienced, being out on the open sea. But here you've got a bizarre kind of confluence, because part of the time they were sort of abandoned on the open ocean, and then part of the times they're landlocked. And so, yeah, there was a lot to contend with.
Right. And most people could imagine what that would be like, since we all have exposure to cold, but almost none of us have exposure to constant darkness. And without getting too far ahead of ourselves, that's something that just blows my mind when I read these accounts. Because your book is a story of man versus nature, before we get too far into the details of the expedition itself, could you tell me the climate of Lady Franklin Bay? What is it like? If you went there, or you were there in the 1800s, what would the weather be like? What would the climate be like? What would be the challenges that you would face going there?
Right. So there's a kind of haunting beauty in this region. And, you know, we're very fortunate to have a great number of images that were taken by one of the crew members, George Rice. So you get a sense of what it was like, but also the descriptions by by Greeley and Brainerd and some of the other members. But what you're talking about is really a bit like, say, Norway or New Zealand in certain respects, where it's fjord land. So you've got these incredibly beautiful bays and fingers of water that are punctuated by fairly high mountains, you know, up to 4,000 or 5,000 feet erupting from the sea. Around Lady Franklin Bay, they're wind-shorn and sort of they're plateaued on the top, so they aren't peak-ish. They're more rounded and humpbacked. And then certainly the vegetation is sparse and short and low and shorn off. There's more wildlife than you might think. So during particular seasons, you know, there's thousands of shorebirds. Greeley and his men encountered herds of musk oxen and wolves and polar bears. And so there is wildlife in spring, which is really short. You know, spring and summer are like, 6 to 8 weeks long. You've got, some vegetation flourishing and becoming green. But, you know, you're talking about just incredibly sort of stark but beautiful landscapes of ice and rock and water.
Right. And then in light of that, this expedition, the Greeley expedition, occurs at the end of the 1800s, the era of polar exploration. Can you tell me, what are some of the challenges and dangers that someone going on a polar exploration would face? And just as some context, there's a great book called The Terror in a miniseries about the Franklin expedition that ends in absolute disaster, and the Shackleton expedition. Some people know about that, but what are some of the things that you could potentially face if you signed up for a polar expedition?
I think one of the things that really punctuates for me how impressive and inspiring some of this kind of expedition is what wasn't known. So, you know, no one at the time of the Greeley expeditions, 1881, had actually been to the North Pole. So there was a great deal of speculation about what it was like up there. Some expeditions prior had been up as far as Greeley's initial camp. But everyone knew that they were going to face ice, of course, which was really dangerous. So these channels that they're moving through get constantly filled with flows, and these flows and bergs, and they varied. You know, there's land ice that breaks off from glaciers and falls into the water and floats around, and then there's sea ice, which is big dismembered chunks, and I mean big, like we're talking about some of these pieces of ice are 15 miles long, that are floating in the water. And so if you're out on in the water, you are in constant danger, and you're trying to wend your way through these serpentine leads of open water, constantly looking, scanning to try to not get crushed by the ice. So you know, these men who were going to go up there, any of them who had read accounts, and Greeley was among those who was very well studied in Arctic expeditions prior, but he had never been there himself, understood that the challenge was really daunting, that crew losses were on average 50%. So as you waved goodbye from the boat to your people on shore and said goodbye to your loved ones, you know, there was a 50% chance that you weren't coming home.
Right. And at this point in the 1880s, what kind of equipment would you have? Because when I read of polar expeditions in the 1850s, people would be wearing almost exactly the wrong clothing. They would be wearing wool, which is great for the Scottish Highlands. But in the Arctic, you sweat in it, but then that freezes, compared to what an Inuit population would wear, where they know exactly how to handle the elements and they have skins that are able to keep them relatively dry and relatively warm. What was it like in the 1880s? Were they wearing clothing that would able to keep them relatively warm, or is it just constant misery, constant shivering, and constant frostbite?
Wow, that's a really great question. And in fact, Greeley talks a lot about their dress and garb, because they go on a number of expeditions. Once they set up Lady Franklin Bay, they go on numerous forays, and he talks a lot about how the men are outfitted. So, you know, Greeley, let me just digress by saying that, you know, Greeley had brought a lot of men from the cavalry and signal corps, and these are pretty hard men who were accustomed to living outdoors for long periods of time, but mostly in the American Southwest. And they had recently been on, you know, on horseback. They were hunting, or not hunting, but fighting Indians and setting up telegraph lines in the American Southwest. But Greeley made a lot of alterations, and he learned from, so he brought along two Inuit Greenlandic sledge drivers, and he stopped in Greenland along the way up and bought skin clothing, seal skin clothing, also fur and hide clothing from musk oxen, and was trying to trying to learn as much as he could from the Greenlanders on proper dress. But what he also understood was that he used a combination of purchased Greenlandic skin and hide garments, including boots, as well as their own sort of really, really thick double boiled wool with a kind of oil skin outerwear, like to fend off rain. But you're right, they were constantly dealing with the fact that when they were working and moving and pulling sledges, they're perspiring. And then when the minute they stopped, everything would freeze. And so, you know, they didn't have the advantages that we have now with breathable Gore-Tex clothes and down. And so there were having to constantly monitor their perspiration output, and then have changes of dry clothes in boxes and bags, so that they could not develop hypothermia and frostbite.
Right. When I read accounts of today of people going across Antarctica or the North Pole, kind of in the steps of Admiral Byrd, who are on skis, yes, they're retracing the steps, but they're in breathable Gore-Tex. They're getting airdrops of supplies. Yeah, not really the same. It's not quite as hard as they had it. Well, yeah, thanks for setting up all the contacts. And I wanted that just because it's almost unimaginable to get into the minds of what these people encountered. But let's look at the Greeley expedition from the beginning now, having said all that. So who was A.W. Greeley? Why did he put together this expedition, and what did he want to accomplish?
Right. So it's really interesting. This was a scientific mission, and it was the brainchild of this man named this Austrian guy named Karl Weyprecht, who had conceived of this really ambitious plan to set up a circle of Arctic research stations that circumnavigated the polar region. There would be about 14 of them. And he wanted to have this, it was called the International Polar Year, and it was the first one. And he wanted to have these stations simultaneously monitoring for a year or 2 years the conditions of the polar north to better understand it in terms of all sorts of categories of science, magnetism, tidal movement, wind speeds, temperatures. And so it was really ambitious, and he had the support of numerous nations. And Greeley had found out about this, and working with some of the folks in the U.S. government, he was actually an army man, and Greeley was a Civil War veteran and had been working most recently in the Signal Corps, setting up telegraph lines across the American Southwest. But he had this fascination with polar exploration just from his own readings. And so he managed to get himself chosen to be the leader of the expedition for the American contingent, which would be the most northerly of all of these research stations. And it was so remarkably at the time when it all ultimately came together, Karl Weyprecht, in fact, had passed away. And Greeley was able to continue on the work. And so the International Polar Year went on in Weyprecht's name. But what was remarkable was that Greeley's group, which, you know, were these men who weren't wholly suited, I have to say, for this kind of duty, because in a lot of ways it might have been better initially served by a Navy contingent. But, once the thing is, they traveled by water all the way up to where they were, which is in to set the place. It's between Ellesmere Island in Canada and Greenland, really, really far up, almost to the top of both, in this little bay called Lady Franklin Bay. And Greeley and his men were dropped off there on this ship called the Proteus, which they were brought there and deposited. And I can talk a little more about their initial fort and everything. But yeah, just to sort of summarize, it was an army mission that was part of the International Polar Year, and it was three-pronged. It was scientific. It was also supposed to look for the remnants of this lost ship Jeannette, which had disappeared 2 years before. It was also a U.S. ship. And then third, and perhaps most important to Greeley, they were going to try to break the record of farthest north or reach the North Pole.
This record of farthest north, who reached that before them?
Well, so farthest north had been this sort of holy grail of a highest northern latitude, and the British had waved the flag of farthest north for approximately 300 years. They just kept breaking their own record, and that is in part because they were pioneers in this exploration of this region. And so they just kept going a little farther every few decades, including the Franklin trips to the Northwest Passage. But even before that, there was this British man named Frobisher. And so Greeley was really patriotic and competitive, and he secretly wanted to break the record and was quite prepared to do everything he could to do so.
Huh. Well, let's look at the beginning when they arrive at this island and the expedition is beginning. How does it initially begin, and how do things eventually go wrong?
Right. So the book is set up in, I think, two central parts, which is life at Fort Conger and then life after Fort Conger. So in 1881, Greeley and 24, we'll call them scientist explorers, but many of them were cavalrymen were conveyed on this ship, the Proteus, to Lady Franklin Bay, which was way, way up, like I said, you know, it was on the eastern boundary of northern Ellesmere Island. And it's kind of a big open finger of water that is, protected by a bay and a harbor. And so they're brought on this 200-foot steamship called the Proteus. And remarkably, they had with them enough gear and food for 3 full years. And I'm talking about pre-cut lumber, thousands of pounds of pre-cut lumber that is enough to build a 65-foot elaborate longhouse that included bunks for the men and captain's quarters for Greeley and his officers. So they were quite comfortable. They had a full kitchen and coal burning stoves. There was a nearby coal seam that they had discovered about 5 miles away from this place they dubbed Fort Conger. And so they were able to bring coal over and, you know, heat this dwelling, which was important because when they arrived in 1881, it was late. It was August, and Greeley fully understood that by mid-October, the sun would dip down below the horizon at that latitude and then not rise again for 4 months. So they were going to be experiencing this polar darkness. So they hurried and built this really great and double-walled longhouse, and then they set to doing their scientific work. And so everything was going. Now, they were attacked by wolves, and there was an outbuilding fire that caught one of the men on fire, and, you know, they experienced some incredible weather. Now, meanwhile, the Proteus that has dropped them there, as soon as the ice and water conditions were favorable, it left and went back to the United States, or back to Nova Scotia, or Newfoundland. And so they were left there. And so that was a sort of daunting and poignant moment when the ship sails away. And now they know, okay, well, we're going to be resupplied in a year. That's the plan anyway. So everything was going great at the, at Lady Franklin Bay at Fort Conger, despite, you know, having to contend with 100, sometimes winds nearing 100 miles per hour and temperatures plunging to, you know, 75 degrees below zero. So, yeah, there they were.
Hey, everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. I can't even imagine that because for someone in the lower 48, the closest experience I have is I've seen YouTube videos of someone in Fairbanks, Alaska, where they go outside when it's 40 or 50 below. They throw a bucket of water up in the air and immediately turns into steam because of how cold it is. When it's that cold up there, are they basically confined to their cabin until it's possible to go out and conduct experiments?
So that's a great question. Greeley was adamant that they stay busy for a number of reasons. I mean, in part because of what happens to the human mind when you're confined for long periods of time, especially in darkness. So he had them taking readings in all conditions. So they would have small teams, and sometimes they'd have to be roped together because the wind was howling so much. But you know, he kept them very busy. They were taking up to 500 readings a day with instruments. And he kept them constantly out doing exercise. He even organized a school that they had inside the fort. They would have lectures and do problem solving. And he had them doing sorts of games like snowshoe races and marksmanship races. And then there were men who were devoted specifically to hunting. So people were always doing something, you know, and there was, he tried to not have them be idle because of the mental problems that would create.
When are they expecting the resupply? Sometime in the summer or the fall for the next year?
Right. So the plans were really detailed. And of course, really knowing that they were going to be just dropped off, and communication, as it was back then, being you really needed ships to deliver letters. And so there was a really detailed plan, which included the next summer, 1 year from the time they were dropped off, they were supposed to, a ship was supposed to come to them and bring them more supplies, but most important, bring them information from back home, and also convey back from Greeley, you know, some of the information that he had garnered, news of their exploits to the farthest north and news of their science. And so there's this really moving period when they the first season, you know, Greeley and the men have a pretty great winter. They celebrate Christmas and Thanksgiving that first year. And there's lots of, they have tons of food, and they have cigars, and they're having parties and singing and dancing and you know, really having a pretty good time of it, and making these expeditions on foot and sledge to try to break records and find places that have never been seen before by man. And I should mention that at the time they're the farthest northern living inhabitants in the world. And then the next summer they start anticipating the arrival of this ship that's going to bring them news from home. And there are these incredibly moving scenes of them just going up onto these 2,000, 3,000 foot bluffs and looking out into the bay and in the Kennedy Channel, looking for masts of a ship. And they, you know, they just stare out at the water and watch the condition of the water and notice that it's really filled with ice. And that ship never comes, and they don't know exactly why, but for reasons that I get into, and that's kind of the fun of the way I was able to write this book, is I cut back and forth between them staring out to sea and then what's actually going on to the south, where ships that are being sent to try to find them are having troubles of their own.
Why couldn't a ship come? Was it ice floes or something else?
Yeah. So remarkably, when Greeley went there, they experienced a super mild summer. And so they made kind of record time going up to Lady Franklin Bay, and it was unusual. And so what ends up happening is that there's a kind of complacency with sending the resupply. And what the reader finds out is that these resupply ships are not able to move through these bodies of water that are choked with ice. And so you get to see their troubles and having to turn back, and they've got all these supplies and more food, and they're supposed to also be dropping. There are really elaborate detailed plans about if they can't make it to Greeley, they're supposed to drop food and caches of food and clothing and gear and at very specified places. And then there's a series of unfortunate events which make that problematic too. And so everything begins to kind of, we see it slowly unraveling even before Greeley does.
Okay, well, this is where things really go south, when they realize that a ship isn't going to come. I could imagine if I were there, I'd be thinking about something like the Franklin Expedition, where no one knows what happened, but I'm sure there are legends that they try to leave the ship, go on foot, they get caught in the weather, there's evidence of cannibalism, there's all this stuff. So what happens when the ship doesn't come the next year? How are they on supplies? What are they thinking of staying or going, and how is that?
Right. So this is sort of the crux moment of Greeley's leadership in the expedition. So another year goes by, and they do all sorts of exploring, and then the summer happens, and there's a date in early August by which Greeley has determined, and it's been written in orders, that if resupply doesn't make it to him, that he's going to depart and leave Fort Conger and head south to this place 250 miles away to the south called Cape Sabine. And we also see that the Proteus, which originally brought them there, is trying desperately to get to them, and it has all sorts of problems again with the ice. So there's this really devastating foreshadowing, because we see what happens to a 200-foot-long steamship in the ice. And then Greeley and his men, he decides, you know, with some of the men kind of grumbling at this point, because the comforts of Fort Conger are such that they have everything they need. And so some of the men want to stay there, but Greeley, he's their leader. He's an army man. There are orders. And he says, you know, by this date, in early August, we're going to leave. We're going to board up Fort Conger, take everything we need. And they have like a 28-foot long steamship dubbed the Lady Greeley. And they have about five other oar-driven whale boats. And they string these all behind the Lady Greeley and head off into these ice-choked waters heading south. And at that point, nothing is ever going to be the same. And so you then enter this incredible world of floating ice that can kill you, of weakening ice that if you walk on it and you break through, you're going to drown. And of just towering icebergs all around you that will crush your ships. And so they begin this arduous descent to the south, where they're moving from open water to shore constantly, sort of dodging icebergs, sometimes living on them. It's incredibly tense for months.
And the 24, 25 men who are originally on the expedition, their numbers continually shrink. Do most of the deaths occur during this trip south, or was it already happening?
No. And so that's one of the things that Greeley was most proud of. I mean, so for the 2 years that they're at Fort Conger, they strike to farthest north, they go farthest west, they discover all these hundreds and hundreds of new miles in Greenland that have never been explored before by non-native peoples. And he loses not a single man. And even in their descent, the 250-mile descent south, he loses not a single man. I mean, there are really close calls. People fall overboard and into the water and, you know, are pulled back onto the ships or onto their boats. And like, you know, they have to quickly change their clothes because they're getting frostbite, you know. But by the time they make their way, and they have literally been on one iceberg that's being ground down from other icebergs and split in two. They're on that thing for like a month, just floating aimlessly. They finally get to shore. And even then, remarkably, he has not lost a single man. And so what conspires against them ultimately is starvation, because the food sources that were supposed to have been left for them were not left where they were meant to be left. And also, unfortunately, the game that was fairly plentiful near Fort Conger, it's sparse where they land. So really, even then, they hang on. These men are incredibly industrious, I have to say. I was so impressed by their abilities to bag what game there is. We're talking Arctic foxes and lots of shorebirds. And then the Greenlandic guys are really good at getting seals. And so, you know, they're eking out this subsistence on this rocky, barren shore for something like eight, nine months with dwindling food stores of their own.
Here, where they were expecting to find this food cache, but it's not there. Are they remaining at the spot waiting for a ship to come, or are they continuing to move? Where are they at this point?
Right. So once they get to this place called Cape Sabine, that is where the predetermined orders suggested that there would be caches left for them and or a ship would come. Now, importantly, directly across from Cape Sabine on the Greenlandic side is this place that they had stopped over at it's called the Smith Sound, and it's only 22 miles away. It's tantalizingly close. In fact, from their promontories at Cape Sabine up on the bluffs on a clear day with their telescope or binoculars, you can actually see the outline of the shore. And they know that right there, there's this place called Pandora Harbor. There's a population of Itah natives, who have huts, dwellings, food, shelter, warmth. And so they're constantly scanning the water and the ice to see whether they can get over there, possibly, whether a ship might have come there, and then whether a ship, of course, is going to come for them. And so it becomes this really sort of painful, it's a race against time where the reader knows that finally ships are going to be dispatched for them. Greeley has men scouring the shores and sending them out on these food finding missions because somewhere they know that there are these caches. And in those days, they would place caches of food under giant cairns of rock. So the man, he would send a couple men out on week-long food finding missions, and they're really, really hard because the men are really struggling at this point, they're malnourished. And so you've just got there's so much humanity, I think, where men are risking their lives for the group and they're hanging on and they're hoping at this point, they arrive at Cape Sabine in October of 1883 and the sun is about to go down and they know there's no ships going to come until at the very earliest June. So then it's just about survival.
Yeah. At this point, I'm sure there are fears of cannibalism, people just, mutiny, everything else, of a group of people wanting to strike out, go this way or that way. So what's going on once they get to this point, and how does Greeley manage to keep them from falling into complete chaos?
Right. Well, Greeley at this point has altered his leadership style to a degree. So he's letting some of his men, he's a great delegator. He's letting some of his men, everybody has their role, whether it is to be off hunting, to try to net shrimp, to go try to find food. And he maintains, so they've built a small hut using one of their whale boats as a roof. And at this point, it's a low ceilinged hut, so none of them can actually stand up in it. But it's about 25 feet long, and so they sit with their backs against the wall and their feet out toward the middle, and it has kind of a tent pole with a lantern up at the top. And so they take turns, doing different jobs, going out to break holes in ice to get water. And then some of the men are hunting and they have some success. But they're basically hanging on. And Greeley, again, he institutes these lectures so that the men, their minds stay active. But it is, in a way, it's a descent into madness. And some of the men certainly begin losing their grip. There's stealing of food. There's a particular man who, the others notice that he's not losing weight and they start to suspect that he's stealing food. And in fact, he is. And he gets caught a few times. And so Greeley has to decide, okay, the punishment for that, is execution. And so Greeley has to weigh whether to execute this man is going to bring just degrade morale even further. So he's faced with lots of really hard decisions. And the other men, are trying to do whatever they can to keep their wits and their hope. It's really incredible. The sort of what I think, you see men in their most vulnerable states, and also how some surface and exhibit true heroism.
Right. What are some of those things that stand out to you of bravery beyond Greeley when they're facing this with these odds?
Well, so there are a couple people who are noteworthy. I mean, there's a man named George Rice, who I mentioned early. He's the photographer, and the book is populated with probably 50 images, most of them taken by this man named George Rice, who proves to be incredibly resourceful, not only as a photographer, but he's hardy, and he's willing to go out in any conditions and try to find food. They believe that there's this cache of food that they've read about from a previous expedition called the Narez expedition, that has hundreds and hundreds of pounds of canned meat. And so there's a couple guys. One of them's name is David Brainerd. The other one is Lieutenant Lockwood, and then George Rice, who are, they're very hardy, and they're willing to sacrifice their own health and conditions for the others. And so on numerous occasions, you know, men will, and the Greenlanders, I must say, these two continue to hunt through all conditions. And it's very dangerous. They've got skin kayaks. And so they're constantly going out on the water and trying to shoot seals and walruses. And, you know, it's that you see these incredible moments of near misses near successes, where they'll shoot a walrus that's on an ice floe. And then, as they get near it, it'll slip into the water and sink. And you've got these, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of meat and fat that they desperately need. And you just see it sinking into the water.
Oh man.
Brutal.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't imagine the disappointment when you think this could be the difference of life and death. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. When they're caught in this encampment, eventually some do survive. So how are they finally able to reach civilization?
Right. So what's really amazing is that you, again, I was able to toggle back and forth between what's happening in the United States and Greeley and his men will leave them temporarily in some state of peril. And I chuckle only because, in hindsight, you have the ability, it's certainly not funny for Greeley and his men, but, from the standpoint of cinematic, dramatic effect, you're able to see what's going on back home. And so one of the things that's really compelling is the efforts of Greeley's wife, Henrietta, who has never given up hope, even though they have no information except for these ships that are going to go try to resupply him and or rescue him are not succeeding. And so Greeley's wife, Henrietta, remains just dutiful and steadfast in her efforts to have the U.S. government not leave them there. And so she organizes, and I mean, she writes letters to the president. She has, she's well connected with newspapers across the country, and she creates a kind of national frenzy about, it'd be like if we had left some men on Mars, you know, and then Washington was sort of foot dragging about whether we should go get them. And so she creates this basically international, because we end up getting help from England, and they offer a ship. And so ultimately there's enough impetus to rally this rescue mission that the U.S. Navy decides that it's time for them to step in. And so you've got Greeley clinging for life on this little spit called Cape Sabine, with dwindling numbers. And then you've got this Navy man named Winfield Schley, who is picked to commander this relief rescue expedition. And so it's really dramatic, because they end up retrofitting this ship with all sorts of ironclad prow, and they bring explosives. And so they decide, we're going to blow our way all the way to Greeley if we have to. And so you've got this, and then also there's an international contingency of whalers who are up there, Henrietta Greeley has organized a bounty of $25,000 for anyone who can find or get information about Greeley. So you've got like a dozen Arctic whaling ships that are really, they're knowledgeable about these waters, and they're kind of racing and helping Schley and this armada of three rescue ships. And it's this really great sequence where they're all charging north. And then I cut back and forth between what's happening with Greeley and his men and these ships that are hell-bent on finding him. And without giving away too much, I'll just say that ultimately, when things are look like they are at their most dire and that everyone is going to perish, then the ships, they find these cairns and find some information that suggests to them that Greeley might be in the vicinity. And then there's an incredible rescue.
Well, to tie in the end of the story, I always love hearing what it's like when they're finally rescued, whether Shackleton and his men finding the whaling outpost and they're feeling warmth and fresh food for the first time in years. I don't know if Greeley described that. So that's one thing. What was it like for them when they were finally rescued? But a big question I wonder when I hear this is, this story has all the elements of heroism that we do know, like Ernest Shackleton, who's a national hero in England for bringing men back from the absolute brink of death. It sounds like explorers that are celebrated, like Edmund Hillary, who's, I think, on banknotes in his homeland in New Zealand. So why don't we know about Greeley? Why do you think that he isn't remembered the way these other people are when it seems like he's matched all the feats that they accomplished?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, and hopefully, you know, part of my, well, not goal really, but part of what I hope the book does is bring more attention to Greeley, because I view him as a national hero. I mean, when they're rescued, they're brought back to Canada at first and then to the United States. And they do receive a huge hero's welcome. I mean, there's thousands of people lining the shore and they're feted. There's a banquet and all of this, but the return is marred by the discovery on the ship that Schley, so there, many of the men were buried very near, Cape Sabine at this encampment called Cemetery Hill. And so Schley determines that they need to bring these U.S. soldiers back. And so they dig them up. And when they load them onto the ships and put them in like this embalming liquid, they realize that some of the men have chunks of their thighs and backs sort of removed by what looks like knives or scalpels. And so there starts to be these rumblings about cannibalism. Now, none of the reports during none of the diaries or the records that Greeley elaborate field notes, you know, mention cannibalism. And so there's speculation about, you know, what exactly happened. And in fact, you know, there's no one ever ultimately says that cannibalism occurred, but it sure looks like it when you see the precision of the cuts. And one of the men who was on the trip is this Creole doctor named Octave Paby. And he, you know, so there's speculation that like the cuts were made with like surgical precision. But there's also the question of it's controversial. And there's the question of whether or not the meat that was being taken from these dead men was being used to bait the shrimp traps that they were using to catch. They were kind of running out of all meat to bait these shrimp traps that they were catching their shrimp in. And so it's not absolutely definitive. And Greeley and a couple of the survivors make a pact that they will never speak of it. That's part of the reason that Greeley's reputation, at least at the beginning of his homecoming, was marred. But, you know, he goes on to have an absolutely remarkable career. I mean, he co-founded the National Geographic Society, the Explorers Club, and you know, he ends up receiving the Congressional Medal of Honor, which at the time when he received it, was only one other man had received it for non-wartime exploits, and that was Lindbergh. So, you know, the guy is he's certainly respected and should be respected at the highest levels of exploration achievement.
And you had mentioned earlier what they accomplished, that they reached farthest north, the scientific observations made. Beyond those discoveries, what do you think is the legacy of this expedition that you think people should remember?
I look at the Greely expedition a bit like lunar exploration. You know, no one had been there before. So it takes incredible courage to go somewhere where a man has never been. There's so much unknown. And the scientific aspect of it is not to be dismissed. So Greely brought back, and that's the other thing that I think is really amazing, is when they left Fort Conger, Greely determined that he was going to bring all of their scientific records in these big water-sealed crates that were heavy and cumbersome, and they lugged these things in and out of these boats for months. And on numerous occasions, Greely, you know, says to the men, "Should we abandon this stuff?" Because he puts it up to a vote, and everyone agrees that they need to bring it, because if they do not survive, they want the record of what they've achieved to survive them. And so I think, you know, that kind of scientific minded exploration is probably the legacy. And as a side note, there's currently right now, there's an international consortium expedition called Mosaic, and there's a ship called the Polar Stern, which, you know, 100 plus years later, is locked in the ice, and it's floating and studying for a year conditions in the polar north. And it's remarkable that this is something that, you know, Greely and his men were doing so long ago, and that we still are trying to unlock the secrets and the mysteries of the polar north. And Greely was one of the pioneers.
Well, I am blown away by the way that people could survive these conditions, probably the hardest that anyone could face. And as you mentioned in our discussion, there's a lot more to unpack in this story. And your book is Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greely Polar Expedition. Buddy, thank you for joining us. And if people want to learn more about your book and other projects you've been up to, where's the best place to find you online?
Sure. You can just go to buddylevy.com.
All right. I'll include that in the show notes. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, Scott. Great talking to you.
There you have it. That is all for today's episode. I'd like to kick things off by thanking the Spy Masters for this episode, and I'll explain what that is in a second. Vic Austin, Chris, Rob Matlock, Alan Baker, Beverly Ingle, Jake Harrington, Todd Warren, William Ivey, Michael, Chester, Melissa, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Daniel Lawson, Moondoggy from Ohio, David Powell, William Ivey, Josh Reddick, Tim Clark, Tim Powell, Carl from Norway, Tom from Ohio, Chris C., Nick Brooks, Jennifer French Lee, and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the intelligence officer level, get all the stuff that scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.